Thank you, Su Yang. It's good to see you all. Thanks for coming to this evening's lecture. I'm going to begin sharing my screens now. In this lecture, I will talk about a systems-based view of cognition. I'll present this view and defend it against some objections. But I'll begin by motivating it with some remarks that will seem familiar to those who were present yesterday. I'll review this material somewhat quickly, but it's a useful stage setting. So what's in the background here is the debate about extended mind and cognition, which was the focus of yesterday's lecture. It's long been recognized that two kinds of causes contribute to the production of intelligent behavior. For example, the statue that reflects light and is subsequently avoided in skillful navigation, and the increased activation of neurons in primary and secondary visual cortex, which contribute to avoidance behavior. Both of these are causes of the intelligent behavior, the successful navigation of the environment without, you know, knocking one's head on the statue and causing a bruise and falling down. A neutral way to understand the claim that cognition is extended would be the following. Of those two kinds of cause, the kind of cause that cognitive scientists used to think was only inside the organism frequently appears outside the organism. And this is the kind of cause that we normally thought activation in visual cortex was, is just like, or is of the same kind as a lot of causes that are found outside the organism. Those are grouped together with the cause contributed by visual cortex. The initial challenge then is to extract by reflection on working cognitive science, a principle that distinguishes the two kinds of cause, regardless of what we call them, to find a principled and consistent distinction that plays a central role in cognitive scientific modeling. In yesterday's lecture, I argued that a theory of cognitive systems can help to resolve questions about cognitive extension, or purported cognitive extension, anyway, establishing a line beyond which only one kind of cause appears, the ones we're inclined to call non-cognitive causes. But there are further reasons to ask about cognitive systems. Identifying the cognitive system might delimit the boundaries of the the cognitive self. And this is a theme that will begin appearing more over the next few days. I'll talk more about the self. Point of clarification is in order. When I talk about cognitive systems, a cognitive system does not refer to a subsystem or a module as parts that have dedicated tasks within a larger cognitive system, right? Rather, a cognitive system is a collection of such things and perhaps other resources, as they together constitute a single cognitive being, the subject of cognitive states, the thing that develops, learns, and acquires new skills, including perhaps skills supported by task-specific subnetworks, the sort of thing that stands a chance of being the cognitive self. Now, this is important for a reason I've just emphasized. I'm interested in the self. I'm interested in sort of the subject. But it's also important because we don't want to assume at the outset that there are dedicated subsystems, that there are modules. It might be much, much messier inside the brain, or in the cognitive system, more generally speaking. One of the kind of motivating goals of the view that I'm presenting today about cognitive systems is that it be ecumenical, that it not pick sides in various debates about computational approaches to cognition versus artificial neural networks, you know, versus dynamical systems, debates about, you know, modularity, whether subsystems are informationally encapsulated and function on their own without input from other systems. The approach that I will describe today to the individuation of cognitive systems is neutral with regard to these issues. And I think that's one of its Your strong point. All right. So what is the source of this principle of individuating cognitive systems or using cognitive systems to separate where cognition occurs from the location of other factors? Successful cognitive scientific modeling of a variety of stripes, including computationalist, connectionist, dynamical systems-based, subsumption architecture-based, and brute biological, produces models through which a deep distinction runs, the distinction between the elements of the relatively persisting set of integrated components, their nodes, connections, layers, memory registers, basic computational operations, areas of cortex, or what have you. And on the other hand, the passing parade of other causal contributors. The linguist Margaret Wilson talks about the difference between obligative systems and facultative systems in her early work on situated cognition. And that's the similar kind of distinction here. There's the kind of persisting system that is brought to bear on any of the sort of tasks. And then there's the stuff that comes and goes and makes a contribution and passes on. And this seems to be the deepest distinction. Some of the things in the latter category in the passing parade of other causal contributors, they're often what we would think of as the stimuli, say in my example earlier of the statue. The statue is the stimulus. It's causally contributing though as the stimulus. And so we treat it as a contributor, but a different kind of causal contributor. So the proposal I made yesterday was that we should call this relatively persisting, relatively integrated entity, the individual's cognitive system, which one might also call the cognitive architecture. The causes of the kind that were historically thought to appear only inside the organism are better thought of as ones that appear only within the architecture or cognitive system, wherever that happens to be. The operative question then becomes, where is the human cognitive architecture? Well, what are the typical boundaries of the human cognitive system? I'll recap an argument from yesterday's lecture, and then we'll start moving into the newer material. And the idea was that given the historical successes of organism-oriented cognitive science, we should infer that at least one full cognitive system exists within the boundary of the human organism. We have had great success in many research programs, not all research programs, but there are many. We've had great success taking individual organisms, testing them in one set of circumstances, testing them in a different set of circumstances, testing them in a different set of circumstances, and finding correlations in their behavior across those sets of circumstances, which suggests that there's something important and consistent throughout those cases. The hypothesis that a cognitive system appears within the boundary of the organism and is a distinctive contributor to the production of the explananda of cognitive science best explains why this construct of a persisting system appears in all of the various forms of successful organism-centered cognitive scientific modeling. If there weren't such a system inside the organism, these modeling efforts wouldn't have worked as well as they did. But then I went on to argue that there's no more than one human cognitive system. You know, that just because there's one inside the organism doesn't stop the proponent of extended cognition from saying, hey, but maybe there's more. Maybe there are other cognitive systems that humans are a part of that extend out into the environment and include artifacts and tools. Considerations of simplicity, however, recommend that we posit at most one cognitive system per typical human. All parties must admit the importance of the interface between the organism-bound cognitive system and other causal contributors, and include such interaction in their models of the production of intelligent behavior. Whether you call that interaction coupling or recruitment or what have you, there is an interface between the cognitive system inside the organism and the tools or other resources in the environment that get used, that it's not an unmediated process of picking up and using those tools. It seems gratuitous then to introduce an extended cognitive system comprising the internal one, the external materials, and the interaction between them. The extended view would be doing everything the more conservative approach does, presupposing all of the same entities and structure, but then making an additional ontological commitment to an additional cognitive system, which violates the principle of simplicity. The choice is between a conservative view, what I called yesterday the hypothesis of embedded cognition or HEMC, and an already established internal cognitive system. That is, an already established internal cognitive system plus external things interacted with and interactive processing, and the extended view, which has the same components, an internal cognitive system, external things interacted with, interactive processing, plus an additional cognitive system, which is all of the preceding elements put together. A, option A, wins out on grounds of simplicity. There are complaints in the literature on philosophy of cognitive science and beyond, philosophy of science more generally, and maybe in metaphysics, about principles of simplicity that can be complicated to apply. It can be difficult sometimes to figure out whether one theory is simpler than another. But in some cases, the comparison is very straightforward, where one theory has exactly the same entities and forces and interactions as another. They line up perfectly. And then it adds one more thing. That seems like the clear-cut case where simplicity applies. If you can do everything with the three components, don't add a fourth component unnecessarily. All right, there's a possible complication here that I didn't take into consideration yesterday. The preceding argument carries significant weight, but it also raises the question of what makes the organismically internal cognitive system an integrated system. And in doing so, it raises the possibility that our best theory of integration might characterize cognitive systems in a way that applies to some extended systems after all. One must respect the canon of simplicity, to be sure, but not at the expense of consistency. So simplicity is very important, but there is a further question that arises: what makes the internal system, the cognitive architecture, so to speak, what makes that an integrated system? What makes it an architecture, which suggests integration and this kind of integrity of a single structure? Well, and once one proposes, defends, maybe even establishes a particular theory of integration, then that theory as a description of a particular structure, that theory might apply in unexpected places. If we find something that meets the description given by that theory, then consistency requires that we acknowledge that the theory applies to it. If we find a human plus external resources system that meets our definition of integration, then we're stuck with that. Consistency requires that we call that a cognitive system as well. So this is a kind of challenge, is to describe integration as well as we can, using the kind of arguments that have established a cognitive system inside the human organism. And then ask with an open mind whether it applies somewhere else. So I'm going to attempt to characterize in very abstract terms what integrates the components of architectures, thus characterizing cognitive systems in a way that allows for the possibility of extended systems. And I do so by offering the conditional probability of co-contribution account of integration, or CPC. It's very important because this ecumenical idea Because in much of the discussion of extended cognition, there seems to be a very kind of rigid approach taken by the two sides. Some of the critics are very, obviously have their mind made up in advance, and they're very dogmatic about where cognition appears. And often this is driven by consciousness, by a sense that we have a conscious awareness of where we are. And clearly that's inside the head. That's what we're looking out from, is the position inside the head. And that is, you know, often leads to arguments that beg the question against the extended approach. So I'm trying to take a kind of a more neutral approach, look for a location neutral theory of integration, and then let the chips fall where they may, as the expression sometimes goes, just let it apply consistently and deliver whatever results it delivers. All right, so the strategy in broad strokes is to take agreed upon kinds of data as the explanand of cognitive science, basic forms of behavioral data on problem solving and language use and whatnot. Make a list of all the causes, states, activities, and mechanisms that produce such data, and find a measure that clusters those causes into two types, two kinds of causes, as I've been emphasizing, in such a way that this clustering plausibly corresponds to the sort of thing that can serve as an architecture in successful models, while leaving open the possibility that this measure of clustering might, depending on the empirical facts, vindicate some extended cognitive system or systems. Now, I think it's probably a little bit misleading to say find a measure that clusters those causes into two types. Really what happens is it separates the causes into two types by clustering some of them together and leaving the others outside the cluster because they aren't tightly enough connected. So that would be a more accurate way to put that. Find a measure that divides those causes into two types. One of those, one side of the division will be a cluster, and that will correspond to the architecture. All right, so here's the theory. The conditional probability of co-contribution. It's pretty kind of rough going. I'll try to go through it slowly, but it is a well-defined formal approach. I've presented it as a recipe, a seven-step recipe, as if it's something one could do, like a procedure one could go through. Now, this is unrealistic, as you'll see when we begin going through the steps, that the idea that you or I or a team of experimenters could go through this process actually for an individual human is quite unrealistic. There are so many causes, so many causal interactions throughout the course of a single day. There are thousands of patterns of activation that occur in the brain and the body in response to environmental stimuli. There are all the environmental stimuli themselves that are contributing to the output, changes in behavior. So the idea that anyone could make a catalog of these is completely misguided. Nevertheless, I think it's useful to present it as a recipe so you can imagine going through the steps. But what's behind this is really a kind of, you know, objective description of the way the world might be, regardless of how difficult it would be for us to, say, verify this in practice. All right, so relative to an organism at a time, form every non-singleton subset of the mechanisms that have distinctively causally contributed to the production of any form of intelligent behavior exhibited by that organism. Okay. So right here, this step is going to be, you know, in principle, it's clear enough, but in practice would be very difficult to perform. All of the mechanisms that have ever contributed to the production of any form of intelligent behavior on your part, where intelligent behavior is construed broadly. It's all of those kinds of behavior that seem interesting to us when we start doing cognitive science that seem to deviate from the null hypothesis and exhibit what we pre-scientifically would call intelligence or adaptive flexibility. So we make a list of all these mechanisms and then form every non-singleton subset. So that's a big exercise in combinatorics, combining these into two-membered sets and three-membered sets and four-membered sets, every possible set except for the singletons, the single object sets or single mechanism sets. Now, for each of these subsets, relative to each form of intelligent behavior, there is, for each of its proper subsets, a probability of its being a causal contributor to the production of that form of behavior, conditional on every member of the complement of that set contributing causally. Okay, so that's complex. It's easiest to imagine picking one form of intelligent behavior, say speech production, or maybe something more specific like engaging in conversation, or another different kind of behavior would be giving a lecture. So one of the questions in the background here is definitely how to individuate forms of behavior, how to cut them up, how to carve them up into kinds. It's also important to ask how to individuate mechanisms, where there's one mechanism or where there's two or where there are three. These are difficult questions and they are independently important. And there are things that I think are works in progress that have to be developed along with successful science. We try out different categorization schemes and see how well the science develops. Maybe we end up having to chop the behavior up into more fine-grained categories, or maybe we have to lump the behavior together, similarly with the individuation of mechanisms. Okay, so that was a little bit of a digression to try to acknowledge that I'm presupposing some things. One of the things I'm presupposing is that we have a taxonomy of forms of intelligent behavior. So let's assume that we've got one kind of intelligent behavior, say engaging in conversation. There is, for each subset of mechanisms, a probability of its being a causal contributor to the production of that form of behavior, conditional on every member of the complement of that set's contributing causally. So once you've identified the behavior, kind of the form of behavior, then you have all of these possible subsets. Some of them are two-membered, some of them are 25-membered. And for each of these subsets, you've got kind of, you've got different ways of splitting them into two categories. If you have a two-membered subset, it's quite easy. Two members would be, you have the question, what is the probability that the first member is contributing given that the second member is? Then you can ask the other question. What is the probability that the second member is contributing to that form of behavior given that the first member is? So having two members in the set keeps things fairly simple, but the construction allows for many members of a given set, in which case there are many different ways to divide that set into two groups, and you have to go through and calculate a conditional probability for each one. Now, in a way, this is good. I mean, it's part of the idea of this, that we're constantly looking at kind of how many teams there are, so to speak, how many collaborations there are, what's the strength of all the different ways of measuring collaboration. What is the strength of all the different possible collaborations, all measured in the same way of conditional probabilities. All right, and then rank order such conditional probabilities. Probabilities fall on in a range from 0 to 1. So it may be that if a given mechanism is active and contributing to the form of intelligent behavior that we're interested in, maybe there's just zero chance that some second mechanism will be contributing. Or there could be a 100% probability, 100% chance that the second one is contributing, because the first one always works together with the second, even if the second could work alone in some other context. So We'll have these numbers from 0 to 1, 0.57, 0.21, 0.684. Right? We'll have all these conditional probabilities associated with all these different sets of either two or more members divided up internally. And once we have this list, this rank ordering of them from highest to lowest, we take the natural cutoff between the higher probabilities and the lower ones. If something's being an integrated system is a legitimate binary scientific property or kind, and the current proposal is on the right track, we should expect such a statistically significant gap to appear. Discard all the entries below the gap. Now, it might be that in the end, we want a measure of integration that is not binary, that isn't, that doesn't draw a definite ring around the cognitive system. But for the purposes of individuating a cognitive system, saying, here's the system, you know, and this other stuff is not part of the system, there's a boundary here. For that purpose, we want a binary property. One of the, it'd be worth acknowledging one of the historical precedents here. There's a sociologist, anthropologist at the University of California, San Diego, named Edwin Hutchins, who wrote a very influential book in the 90s called Cognition in the Wild that contributed a lot to the rise of the situated cognition movement. And he, you know, I was inspired by his approach, although his approach was, I think, much too narrow. But his idea was that we see lots of computational activity in the world. Lots of computing is going on. And he said to look for steep drop-offs in the gradient of computing. You know, sort of thinking about computing as if it were, I don't know, sort of temperature. And you look for sudden drops in temperature around the edges of a weather system. Similarly, you look for sudden drops in computational activity, and that would tell you where the edges of a cognitive system are. It's an interesting proposal, but I'm trying to go beyond that and describe something that's more all-purpose, that has doesn't depend on computation, for example. All right, so moving on, remember where we are. We have made a list of all these conditional probabilities. We've found a gap on this list, and we've thrown away all of the conditional probabilities that are below that gap. I'm not presupposing the gap will be in any particular place. It might be high. It might be that there's a jump from, you know, 80% down to 55%, and that's where, you know, everything's clustered above 80%, and then the rest of the things are down below 55. Maybe that's where the gap would appear, but we, you know, that can't be assumed that there's a magic number in advance where that would be. Okay, but we have a list that's left. For each mechanism appearing on the list of sets with higher conditional probabilities, that is sets that appear above the gap referred to in the previous step, simply count the number of times that the mechanisms appear. This is just a counting exercise. You're going through looking at all these sets that remain, all the ones that were in the higher cluster of conditional probabilities, and looking for a given mechanism. M1 appears 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. You know, just count those and then make a list of mechanisms that itself is rank ordered accordingly, according to the number of appearances of that mechanism above the gap on the list produced by the previous step. A statistically significant gap separates those mechanisms that appear frequently on the list from those do not. At least we can expect this if this kind of integration is a genuine scientific property of a binary sort. The integrated cognitive system comprises all and only those mechanisms remaining, that is, all and only those appearing above the gap on the second list. One thing you might imagine here, let me say one thing before I go on to that. With regard to this second slide, steps 5, 6, and 7, part of what we're doing is we're trying to figure out how integrated a contributor a given mechanism is. Is it really part of the team that works along together with lots of other things in various different subsets, or is it something more special purpose? Something could have a very high conditional probability working together with some other mechanism or some other subset of mechanisms, but only with regard to one kind of behavior, right? So it will only appear on the list one time relative to that kind of behavior. That would be surprising if it was only once, but it will be a small number of times, right? But if it doesn't contribute to other forms of behavior, it won't continue appearing over and over again on the list. And if it doesn't contribute, even with regard to one form of behavior, if it doesn't collaborate a lot with various different subsets of mechanisms, it won't appear over and over. Now, a way of thinking about the broader project or approach is as follows. Maybe this analogy will help. Imagine you're walking out in the hills in an area that's not very densely populated, and you come up over a hillside and look down into a valley, and there is a swarm of construction activity. It's almost as if a small city is being built all at once. And you see construction workers and trucks and cranes and all these things happening. But you notice that there are different colored trucks, and there are different kinds of tasks being carried out. There's a lot of plumbing work being done, and there's a lot of electrical work being done. And you're trying to figure out whether these people are members of different teams, or whether they all work for one contractor or one boss. And then you'd want some way, imagine a situation where you don't speak the same language as anyone involved in the construction project. And so you can't ask people who works together or what company they work for, or whether there are multiple companies involved or only one. You can't ask any of these questions. How would you go about determining whether there are sort of teams or different companies, say subcontractors? How would you go about deciding, how this swarm of activity divides up into different separate streams, if it does? It's this kind of, if all you had access to were the causal facts, you might engage in this kind of exercise of just, carefully measuring the probabilities of co-contribution of all these different individual people, these different construction workers, and figuring out that, there's 6 different teams here that cluster tightly together, but hardly ever work together with each other. Each of these teams may do a variety of tasks, but they don't overlap in their contributions much. That is analogous in this case to finding a collection of different cognitive systems, as if there were different thinkers contributing. Now, of course, as I laid out this construction, I was only imagining finding one, right? One thinker. It's hard enough to characterize this for one, but you could do it to kind of go through the universe and figure out where the kind of clusters of cognition are, so to speak, in the way that I described Hutchins doing. All right, so let's leave the construction domain comparison behind. Maybe that was helpful, maybe it wasn't. But let's look at things that are more, clearly cognitive. As an example of the short-term memory buffer. So let's assume there is such a thing. There is some controversy about what short-term memory is, whether it's the same as working memory, whether those things are genuine components of the cognitive architecture. But the traditional view is that there is a functional component in the cognitive system, which is the short-term memory buffer. So if you ask me to hold a series of numbers in memory, 6248319. I can do that for a second. 6248319. 6248319. I think I got that right. That was being held in my short-term memory buffer. If you ask me 5 minutes from now, you know, to stop the lecture and tell you what that is, I probably will have forgotten it. And so there's for the last 50 years, there's been a fair amount of theorizing in cognitive psychology in the West about what that short-term memory buffer is like exactly. But let's just take it for granted that it exists, and we consider the operation of this memory buffer. Given that a certain speech production mechanism, say one that represents syntactic structure, is contributing to the production of intelligent behavior, the probability is high that the working memory buffer is contributing as well. And this is a case where the probability might be maximal, because in order for, it might be anyway, that in order for a mechanism that represents syntactic structure to contribute to the production of behavior, working memory has to be active. Short-term memory has to be active, because syntactic structures are complex entities. In order for a representation of syntactic structure to contribute to the production of behavior, that representation has to be kept active. The different parts of it have to remain active. And that's just what it is for something to be in a short-term memory buffer, for its for the representation to be kept active. That's a possibility anyway. In that case, the probability would not just be high, it would be maximal, it would be one. And you, with conditional probabilities, there's not symmetry necessarily. So in this case, what I'm saying is, given that the mechanism that represents syntactic structure is operative, we might think there's a very high probability that the working memory buffer is contributing as well, but not necessarily vice versa. So we have to return to that case. Now, for the short-term memory buffer, this pattern will hold across many cases, many kinds of behavior, and many other collections of mechanisms, single or you know, two, three, four in the collection. For very many individual mechanisms throughout the cognitive system, if they're contributing to the production of intelligent behavior, it's likely that working memory is doing so as well. Because, speaking informally, short-term memory buffer is required to complete many different cognitive tasks. Its operation is sort of omnipresent in the cognitive system, to exaggerate a bit. And here I put this in terms of many individual mechanisms, but the measure will be sensitive to the conditional probability of working memory buffer contributing, given that various pairs and triples and so on of mechanisms are contributing. And to go on about that point, the details of the calculation provide the short-term memory buffer with an added boost. It will also appear in many larger sets with high conditional probabilities. For instance, take the set of three mechanisms, the short-term memory buffer, a mechanism that sends motor commands to the vocal cords, and a mechanism that represents syntactic structure. If the latter two are contributing to the production of intelligent behavior, it's likely that the short-term memory buffer is as well. So if the mechanism that sends motor commands to the vocal cords is contributing, and at the same time, the mechanism that represents syntactic structure is contributing, then chances are the short-term memory buffer is as well. Now, it might be that if we focused only on the mechanism that sends motor commands to the vocal cords, the probability would be lower that the short-term memory buffer is active, because the mechanism that sends motor commands to the vocal cords sometimes does so in a very short, sharp manner, like, ouch, you smash your thumb with a hammer, you say, ouch. There may not be any need to keep anything in short-term memory while executing that motor command. So the probability that the short-term memory buffer is contributing, given that the mechanism that sends motor commands to the vocal cords is contributing, will be lower than one, or maybe not even close to one. Right? But if the mechanism that sends motor commands to the vocal cords is active and the mechanism that represents syntactic structure is contributing, then that's probably because a more complex message is being sent to the vocal cords, a more complex command, not simply ouch. In the case where both of those two mechanisms are active, most likely it's because there is a complex sentence that's being executed, a complex sentence that's being produced by this motor command to the vocal cords. And in that case, the short-term memory buffer will be active as well, maintaining the representation of that syntactic structure as active. So one expects the short-term memory buffer to appear many times on the first winners list, as I'm calling it now, the first list. That was the one where we looked at all the subsets of mechanisms relative to each of the different types of intelligent behavior. We looked at all those for high conditional probabilities and cut off the ones below the gap of lower conditional probabilities. So that was the first winners list, so to speak. And if it appears many times on the first winners list, in that case, it will appear high on the ultimate winners list, the list that's made up of the number of times things appear on the first list, the first winners list. The number of times a given mechanism will appear. What about the mechanism that represents syntactic structure? There is a relatively low probability that the mechanism that represents syntactic structure is contributing to the production of intelligent behavior, given that working memory is contributing. Because often working memory contributes to the production of other, in particular, non-linguistic forms of behavior. So in spatial navigation, for example, it may be that I'm keeping in working memory images of landmarks that I've just seen, but without a linguistic coding, in which case working memory or short-term memory would be active independently of without the simultaneous contribution from a mechanism that represents syntactic structure. But this does not necessarily exclude the mechanism that represents syntactic structure from the cognitive system. That mechanism will likely appear in many sets of mechanisms partitioned and evaluated as conditional probabilities, because syntactic representations play a role across a wide range of cases of problem solving, and they do so in combination with various other subsets at high probabilities. The mechanism that represents syntactic structure will be an integrated part of a team, you might think. It will be sort of strongly connected to various other contributors, just won't be to working memory. Keep in mind these kind of two possibilities that will reinforce this message. It's highly likely that the mechanism, the one that represents syntactic structure, contributes alongside various other linguistic mechanisms. Example, those to do with speech processing and speech production and various combinations thereof across various forms of problem solving. Linguistic processing is one of our primary kind of tools, you might think, for solving problems or engaging in intelligent behavior, more broadly speaking. So there, it will depend a bit on how we cut up behavior, but there is, taking exams, there is giving lectures, there is engaging in conversation, there is persuading your children to behave, there's all kinds of things that involve language in one way or another. And although it depends on the details of the case, it would seem to have a high probability of contributing to the production of intelligent behavior, given that any subset of those other kind of speech-related mechanisms are contributing, and then that will be duplicated across a wide range of forms of intelligent behavior, the ones that language use contributes to. So even if I'm using the format normally used to express conditional probabilities. So even if the probability of the activity of the syntactic representing mechanism, given the contribution of short-term memory buffer, right? Even if that probability is low, the probability that the mechanism representing syntactic structure is contributing, given that other language-related mechanisms are contributing, will be high for many such mechanisms. It's likely then that the mechanism representing syntactic structure will be included in the cognitive system. This is what I've been saying for the past couple of minutes. But the second possibility is interesting as well. It's possible that the mechanism that represents syntactic structure contributes to a much wider range of forms of intelligent behavior than one might expect if one is focused only on language-related problem solving. The way I described the mechanism under discussion as one that represents syntactic structure suggests that it's fairly special purpose or has a very kind of focused contribution to language processing. But that might not be the case. It might be a wider range of forms of intelligent behavior that this contributes to. This is especially likely if the structures that represent syntax are shared with other forms of cognition. For example, vision-based problem solving, which is a theme in the cognitive linguistics literature. So if you know, I've been talking about language as if it's kind of a special form of processing, but it might be that the features of language are, reflect deeper features of cognition. The mechanisms that represent those features are active across a wide range of cases. One of the examples discussing yesterday was the example of the schema of path to terminus, right? And maybe that is a part of what we might call syntactic representation, but also vision-based problem solving, in which case the mechanisms that are involved in representing syntax are really much more widely contributing than the description related to syntax alone would suggest. All right, so I've said a bit about the big picture inspiration behind CPC and the purpose of it. I've given you the analogy of discovering a construction activity in the valley that you come across. But it's important, I think, to try to identify also the inspiration behind CPC that comes from cognitive science and this study of cognitive performance, things like task switching and the contributions of different networks across different domains. I mentioned the work a couple of lectures ago. I mentioned the work of Russell Paldrak and Mike Anderson, and that's some of the inspiration behind this. Stanislaus Dehaene has also done some of this work, showing that individual areas of the brain, for example, contribute as parts of different networks to different tasks. So let me say a bit about this kind of inspiration. What is distinctive of cognitive systems is that they engage in flexible problem solving across a wide range of circumstances. That's one way to think of what's special about intelligence, bringing to bear tools that are well suited to the task in a context appropriate way. A collection of resources that contribute in overlapping subsets to the production of a wide range of forms of intelligent behavior is poised to produce this kind of flexibility. Partly because when you have overlapping networks, it's easier to make a transition from one to another. You've already got, if one network is active and it shares some of its components with another network, then parts of the second network are already active. It's primed to be recruited. It's primed to get sort of sucked in and take over. It's kind of already partially there, is the idea, kind of waiting in the wings. This kind of flexibility seems to require a delicate balancing of dynamic profiles of different efficacious sets of mechanisms. That's this delicate balancing is the idea I was just trying to convey with my overlapping portions of my hands. I talk in terms of dynamic profiles because there is one network active, let's say at a given time. It's neurons, if that's what the makes up the network, whatever its mechanisms are, refreshing or firing or something. The energy is diffusing them in some way at a higher rate than other possible networks, because this is the one that's controlling behavior. This is the one that's solving the problem, right? Now, whatever that measure of energy is, of higher energy, a higher energy state, more hertz in the firing of the neurons, right? That is, characterizes all of the elements of the network that's active. That's part of their kind of dynamic profile. Part of the dynamic profile is likelihood of being recruited in a given situation. And so those elements of a given network, an active network, that overlap with the elements of another network are, as I was saying a moment ago, kind of priming the second network to take over. And it's because of this kind of dynamic profile of being near a different attractor well, if you think of it in terms of dynamical systems theory, that the overall system can be pushed from one of its subnetworks into a different subnetwork with overlapping members more easily. I feel like I'm repeating myself, so let me go on. Flexibility may be achieved in human cognition by the presence of many units, circuits, and mechanisms poised to work together in various combinations. On some accounts of this kind of process, subnetworks with overlapping members wrest control from each other via competitive processing. Competitive processing is a commonly used kind of modeling mechanism in cognitive sciences, but it's not always a matter of overlapping networks. I think that's what's kind of that's what this CPC allows for, is this kind of competition between networks that are themselves overlapping. In such cases, a shift in task doesn't require an entirely new network to take control from a previously dominant one. More subtle shifts in the co-activation of elements, some of which are already active, can more smoothly effect such a transition. The systems-based view, CPC, thus emphasizes what seems likely to be a central trait of a system capable of flexible adaptive cognition, that any given mechanism is capable by a direct interaction or by co-contribution of collaborating with various other mechanisms to drive various kinds of task performance. If we're interested in the abstract property of being cognitive, we want the kind or property we identify to capture the most general features of the explanandum, which would seem to be flexible problem solving, or more neutrally, the exhibiting of a wide range of deviations from the null hypothesis, but consistently across varying contexts in a patterned way. And according to CPC, the difference between being a flexible problem solver or not, not being one, is the difference between having an architecture built from a collection of mechanisms that contribute in overlapping subsets to the production of various forms of intelligent behavior. That is an architecture that allows for this kind of switching in a natural way, this kind of flexibility of changing from one strategy to another, or one problem to another. Let me give you a picture. Sometimes, you know, pictures are better than words. I've given you lots of words. Here's a figure from a fairly recent paper by David Amodio, Social Cognition 2.0, an Interactive Memory Systems Account, from Trends in Cognitive Sciences, January 2019. So Amodio is famous for pushing a multiple memory systems account of social cognition. And this is a kind of theme that I've mentioned before in the lectures, the varied nature of memory. Perhaps there is no single thing memory, overarching kind. That's an interesting question. What we do know is that there are various systems that have been discovered as a result of investigating memory. And Amodio's picture includes five: an episodic memory system, a semantic associative priming memory system, instrumental memory system, an aversive conditioning system, and a habit system. Now, one thing to notice about this picture, and it conveys some of the central messages of CPC. I'm not sure who's first. The CPC appears originally in my book from 2009, but it's meant to reflect kinds of things that I was at the time seeing as themes in the cognitive neuroscience literature. And so you see here that each of these five different colored circles has within it a network of nodes, only some of which are active. You see that there are dashed lines running from each of these. So these are kind of behind the scenes interactions, and this can involve overlap. But because these are mostly in different areas of cortex, I don't think Imodio himself is imagining that these are heavily overlapping. But the point of this picture is partly to show the part on the right. In very simple form, you see how different collections of these contribute to different forms of behavior. So in planning or prospection, you get a contribution from episodic and semantic associative memory. So the two contribute. In the case of impression or judgment of another individual in a social context, you have contributions from episodic memory, from semantic associative priming memory, and also from instrumental memory. You see the green arrow going up to impression or judgment. In the case of affective responses, you see instrumental conditioning, instrumental memory system, and aversive conditioning both contributing to the behavior of interest. In the case of face processing, you've got aversive conditioning and semantic associative priming. You've got a blue arrow and an orange arrow. In the case of action or decision, you've got instrumental plus habit. Those two memory systems are contributing. So this kind of gives you in visual form a kind of picture of some of the main themes of CPC, the way in which you've got a variety of mechanisms. They contribute in different clusters, different subsets, to the performance of various kinds of behavior or solving of various kinds of tasks. All right, so earlier I raised the question about the self. What do we think now about the self? Have I identified the self? Consider some of the central traits of the self as it's normally conceived of. Let's sort of pre-scientifically, just when we reflect on our concept of the self. One thing the self does is it engages in reasoning, careful, slow, deliberate, rule-governed reasoning. In particular, the kind that might guide the formulation of life plans or the setting of goals, reasoning that incorporates longstanding commitments and second-order beliefs and values, like second-order beliefs or beliefs about what kind of beliefs I want to have or values related to what kinds of things I'd like to value. I include those because that's part of, you might think, your conception of who you are, right? So we have these very almost dramatic notions of what the self is. It also is connected to conscious experience. It has and reflects on conscious experience. Notice that some of these things are going to be tightly connected to the themes of the very first lecture on the personal level. Often the self is seen as a something appearing at the personal level. It has privileged access to the contents of such reasoning processes and conscious experiences. It has introspective access on this picture. Well, notice though that CPC's cognitive system includes all these things, assuming that each of these is kind of related to a particular range of behavioral performance. Right? We kind of say, well, what does it mean to engage in careful, slow, deliberate, rule-governed reasoning? Well, we want to operationalize this in various ways and measure for it in various ways. And then, you know, most likely these forms of behavior will be produced by mechanisms that appear in CPC's construction when all is said and done and the clustering has been carried out. And presumably the conditional probability of co-contribution approach will yield the cognitive system that includes the mechanisms that produce all of these forms of behavior. Maybe these thought processes behind the forms of behavior end up being identified with those mechanisms. That's a separate issue about identification. And but here's an objection. Fine, maybe the CPC would include all those mechanisms, but some component mechanisms of CPC contribute more than others to the production of especially self-related outputs. For example, in the recounting of one's personal biography, the way we explain our decisions to others, the formulation of long-term plans, and the making of momentous life decisions, the mechanisms that contribute to these things are so different from, this kind of repeats some of the things on the previous slide, but they could compare these to the things they're different from. Compare this to a mechanism that identifies edges in early visual processing, or a mechanism that balances the contribution of syntactic analysis against semantic analysis in the processing of the incoming speech stream. These two factors seem to come into play when we're trying to figure out, kind of predict what's going to be bound to what in a sentence, or how to disambiguate an ambiguous sentence. These processes, though they may wind up as part of CPC, they don't seem to be particularly related to who we are as human selves. It's the concern is that the CPC's output, the cognitive system it identifies, will have too many mechanisms in it, lots of mechanisms that aren't self-related. So a response, maybe there's a surfeit of shifty selves. I should put selves in scare quotes there because I don't really think these different things are selves, but they might be considered as such. Let's for the moment, take on this idea that they're kind of a narrow range of self-related representational structures that don't include things like mechanism for detecting edges in early visual processing, or mechanisms that balance the contribution of syntax and semantics to the analysis of the incoming speech stream. Yeah. So, say we can consider only self-related representational structures and the mechanisms that produce them, such as narrative, maybe. Even if we stick to this, different self-related effects are produced by different representational structures on different occasions. The representation of the self in narrative form is reconstructive in this way. It's pragmatically shifting. The story that we might tell to one audience about who we are may differ from the story we tell to another audience. The structures that represent the self that may guide computation in one context, when we're taking an exam, for example, we think of ourselves as a studious person, have you? That bit of self-representation may not be the bit of self-representation that's active when we're playing football or soccer out on the pitch. And then we might be thinking of ourselves as sporty and capable physically. Self-representations are multiplied along two dimensions, at least across functionally differentiated systems, like different memory systems, for example, and within any one of those, from one temporal appearance to another. So sometimes people talk about the self model, and maybe Thomas Metzinger talks this way, or Albert Navin, some German philosophers. But the self model is misdescribed when the definite article, the, appears before it. As part of what I'm saying is there are lots of different models and different parts of the cognitive system that represent facts about the self. They get activated in different circumstances. They themselves, when they get activated, will vary in their content. So we should be, careful about thinking that there's this well-defined thing, the self, that we can appeal to. Many self-related effects are the products of systems that make heavy use of memory. And memory systems are many, as I saw in Amodio's picture a few minutes back. Their interactions are complex, and some of them are deeply reconstructive. They don't simply encode past experience unadulterated or pure. They encode it in a way that requires reconstruction during access. And that reconstructive process allows for a lot of variation in the output of the process. You remember the same events differently on different occasions. Thus, the content of whatever distinctively self-related representational structure one might have knowledge of will shift from instance to instance of its controlling report or performing of or the performing of any other self-related function. So I'm thinking partly about self-knowledge here, report on oneself, but that can take other forms, like presenting oneself to an audience. And the processing itself is quite messy. So, I mean, we don't have to think only about narrative or only about structures representing the self. More generally, we should doubt the tractability of and the independent scientific motivation for any effort to identify the particularly selfy part of the cognitive system. To the extent that such an effort bears fruit, it's likely to deliver something too messy and fragmented to answer to, say, the pre-scientific or folk psychological concept of the self. With regard to any particular form of self-related behavior, interaction with others, for example, many mechanisms, attention, working memory, visual tracking, will contribute in various subsets alongside the mechanisms were implied pre-scientifically to associate with the self. Think about narrative, my story about myself, my biographical narrative. How do I present that? I've already raised the worry that it's going to take different form on different occasions, depending on the audience, depending on the reconstruction. But I'm adding an extra concern here, or an extra observation, which is that anytime you're presenting your narrative, anytime you're running through your personal biography for others or as part of your own computational processing or other cognitive processing, anytime you do that, lots of other mechanisms will be contributing. If I'm describing my life history to an audience, I will be sensitive to their reactions as an audience. I will see their facial responses. I will see their gaze, whether they seem engaged with the story I'm telling, or whether they seem like checked out or have lost interest. Right? And this involves all kinds of other mechanisms like visual tracking and attention. And so the very production of what we might think of as real self-related behavior is itself going to be shot through with contributions from all kinds of things, even including such seemingly non-self-related mechanisms as mechanisms of early visual processing. They would be required for visual tracking to attend to one's audience, their body language, for example. Thus, we should question the idea that there is a well-defined subset of cognitive mechanisms, just the self-related ones, that contribute to the production of self-related behavior. It's as if we're being asked to carve out just the parts of the internet that are the entertaining parts or the entertainment-related parts. It's a hopeless endeavor, given that so many parts of the internet contribute to the delivery of various bits of content that various people find entertaining. I would conclude then that our best bet is to identify the self with the entire cognitive system as characterized by CPC. It's plausibly delivering the cognitive self. I framed today's lecture against the backdrop of our discussion of extended cognition. I want to come back briefly to that topic because it seems like now that we have a kind of well-motivated, clear account of what demarcates the cognitive system, what draws the boundaries around the cognitive system, now that we have that, we can ask about the search for extended cognitive systems. Most of the resources that are alleged to be external components of extended cognitive processing are special purpose tools, or when considered as material tokens, single instance contributors. Such items will not appear in the cognitive system yielded by CPC. If any extended resource makes it into the individual's cognitive system, it might be, say, a smartphone. That's an example that's been discussed as maybe most likely to be a kind of persisting part of your cognitive system. But that alone would not change cognitive science root and branch. It would add this interesting dimension. Maybe some of us do include a smartphone as part of our cognitive system, even though I'm a bit skeptical about that, but it might participate in the production of a wide range of forms of behavior across, you know, in combination with various other subsystems. But if you're thinking about extended cognition as a kind of whole new way of cognitive science, doing cognitive science, just including a smartphone, at least in some subjects, wouldn't change cognitive science in this sort of radical way that the proponents of HEC have claimed. All right, let's consider now some objections. There have been some published objections, and I'll take a few of these that I think are most important. Andy Clark has objected to CPC on the following grounds. It is unclear exactly how the proposed criteria would fare internally should, for example, the inner neural story turn out to be either strongly modular or worse still, as thus affecting so-called central processing too. And I didn't read that clearly, turn out to be either strongly modular or massively modular. And then there's this parenthetic comment about central processing. But I mean, part of Clark's concern is that we would be chopping up the internal story in a strange way. We'd be chopping up the number of selves or cognitive systems in a way that proliferated them inside the brain. Each module would be contributing. But the CPC does not rule out modular architectures. It does not require us to split architecture with modules into distinct cognitive systems. Visual and auditory mechanisms might be entirely modularized. I don't think that's true, but just for the sake of argument, let's imagine that they are. Yet nevertheless have high conditional probabilities of co-contribution. Integration, I realize the term integration suggests interaction, and sometimes integrated parts do interact. But on CPC, integration can be achieved by mere co-contribution. So if visual and auditory mechanisms were parts of two modularized processes, they nevertheless could at the same time have their influence on output right along next to each other. Maybe after the modules spit out their outputs, you know, they have their privileged or proprietary process that each module goes through on its own without any external influence, then it spits out an output. Those two outputs will go perhaps to motor control, they will then control or causally affect the production of intelligent behavior. So they might do that independently, but nevertheless be highly integrated by CPC's measure. It's like members of a musical group who add their tracks, they add their contribution to a song from different studios in different parts of the world. One person lives in Beijing, one person lives in London, what have you. And they can record the electric guitar or the piano, and then those things can be sent in and mixed together to make one musical performance or one recorded musical track, even though the band members, maybe they're angry with each other and they don't want to talk to each other. So there's not any interaction, but there's co-contribution. There's also a potential problem with change inside a system, at least if one misunderstands the measure. So Philippe de Brigard has published a kind of long pointed critique of CPC, where he focuses on change in a system over time. The neural mechanistic resources used by an organism to accomplish a given kind of task change over time. So, for example, they exhibit a posterior to anterior shift with age, the phenomenon of PASA. There's also some change in lateralization. There are various sort of changes in neural resources as one ages. So older adults are less likely to use posterior resources in the brain in visual processing and attention. And it's, this is, appears across a wide range of different forms of tasks. They're more likely to use anterior materials. DeBrigard says CPC doesn't allow such a shift. And I think he says this because he imagines that what I was trying to identify in the book, he imagines I was trying to identify a collection of subsystems rather than the overall cognitive system. So that's a mistake there. But not only that, but he's thinking of the subsystems as the necessary or dedicated resources for a given kind of task. So I think that's why he believes CPC doesn't allow a shift. Therefore, he thinks CPC is empirically refuted. But it's not part of the goal of CPC to identify a single set of resources that are necessary for the performance of a given sort of task. It's entirely consistent with CPC that different clusters of resources contribute on different occasions. Whether different clusters of resources, that is different subsystems, are part of a single cognitive system depends on the conditional probabilities of co-contribution. DeBrigard hasn't made the case that the PASA shift leaves behind resources that it shouldn't, like sort of leaves in the dust and excludes resources as the change occurs. Because posterior resources continue to be used across a wide range of problem-solving contexts in conjunction with a variety of subsets of other mechanisms. It's not as if the, you know, posterior portions of cortex sort of go dead in older adults. They don't like stop functioning. They're still contributing across a wide range of contexts. Their degree of contribution might be lower. Their extent of activation might be less. But simply, being used less commonly is not going to get them excluded from the cognitive system by CPC's measure. Now, you know, that might be that there is some particular kind of shift connected to PASA that would exclude some materials as they fall out of use or no longer co-contribute along other neural mechanisms or bodily mechanisms, what have you. But that, you know, that requires some detailed work. Just noticing that more of the contribution is made by anterior cortex as one ages, and less of the contribution is made by posterior cortex, does not go any, in and of itself, any distance toward empirical refutation of CPC. What about this problem of ambient light? Colin Klein raises this. I myself raise it in the book as a kind of problem that that might get in the way. I've mentioned the book a couple of times. There's an article that came out shortly after the book that summarizes a lot of this that might be helpful. And I think a more recent article that Thomas has distributed, the very recent article from Cognitive Semantics that goes through some of this in more detail in light of the published criticisms. So light frequently makes a contribution to visual processing across a wide range of contexts, contributing to a wide range of forms of intelligent behavior. And it does so distinctively, contributing in ways it does not contribute to metabolism, respiration, and digestion. In contrast, for example, to the case of oxygen. So, oxygen might think it shows up as a kind of mechanism. It's a very strange way to talk, but you get the idea that somehow oxygen is contributing to all kinds of forms of behavior. But light, it's not doing this. Light is not necessarily part of metabolism or at least not respiration or digestion. It really does play a fairly distinctive role in the production of intelligent behavior. So it stands to reason that the CPC's measure will include it as part of the cognitive system. But this seems wrong. Ambient light is not part of one's cognitive system. So in the case of DeBrigard's criticism from a moment ago based on PASA, he was worried that a CPC was going to exclude things that should be included. And Klein, in this problem of ambient light, has a reverse kind of concern. They worry that CPC will include something that shouldn't be included in the cognitive system. Here's the response. We need to distinguish between token causal contributors and types of causal contributors, which also should distinguish between mechanisms and quantities, which I'll also mention in passing. A given subject's cognitive system is a relatively persistent collection of mechanisms, token mechanisms, that themselves contribute repeatedly over time, or at least are in a position to contribute repeatedly. The light that causally contributes to an instance of visually guided behavior isn't a mechanism, and its contribution is one time only. Light is a pervasive quantity in nature. It's all sort of all around us, small amounts of which interact with the subject and go on their way. There is no single thing like this photon here or this small cluster of photons here that causally contributes repeatedly to the production of intelligent behavior and might have a high conditional probability of co-contribution across a wide range of forms of intelligent behavior and with a large collection of different subsets of other mechanisms. It's not even a mechanism to begin with, but you know, maybe you don't want to put too much emphasis on that. Is it some kind of resource that contributes? Even then, it's this one-off resource, a cluster of neurons, for example, or a family of muscles, right? These are things that persist over time and can contribute to the performance of many different forms of behavior, intelligent behavior, the production of lots of data points of cognitive science. But a particular photon can't do that. So there's a kind of type token confusion that in play here. What about the possibility of multiple significant gaps? This is a concern that both Mike Wheeler and Luke Rolliffs have raised in one context or another. It's possible that multiple significant gaps appear in CPC's seven-step construction at step six as well as step four, which seems to muddy the waters. Recall that step four says, take the natural cutoff between the higher probabilities and the lower ones. If something's being an integrated system is a legitimate binary scientific property or kind, and the current proposal is on the right track, we should expect such a statistically significant gap to appear. Discard all entries below that gap. But if there are multiple significant gaps, well, I think that one of those gaps, the one appearing highest on the list, is the relevant one, and that the others should be ignored. So I mentioned the possibility earlier of a gap between, say, 80% and 55%. But what if there's a clustering of scores between 55% and 35%, and then there's a big gap going down to, say, 15%? Hardly any conditional probabilities appear between 15 and 35. You know, why think that the gap between 80 and 55 is more important than the gap between, right, I just said 35 and 15, right? As a response, if multiple significant gaps appear, the causes of intelligent behavior might divide into three or more types rather than two, which admittedly muddies the waters. Nevertheless, I take heck to concern causes of the type determined by the narrowest band, causes from the most tightly integrated cognitive system, which for the purposes of the debate at hand yields a set of determinate questions to pursue. Right? So these will be the entities above the first significant gap. You start at the top of the list, and as soon as you get to a significant gap, stop there. And that's that, throw away everything else below that. And this is because the radical cachet of heck, the idea of extended cognition, which has attracted so much attention, derives from its strong version, according to which many states and processes beyond the boundary of the organism are of the same kind as those traditionally taken to be paradigmatically cognitive states, the ur-cognitive states, the most obviously cognitive ones. And you would expect those to fall above the highest gap in step six's list, itself presupposing the importance of the highest gap on step four's list. So the idea is let's try to find what counts as kind of like the really integrated cognitive system, the kind of tightly, the self that binds together all these kind of very core mechanisms, paradigmatic cognitive processes. And let's ask whether that sort of thing would include elements beyond the boundary of the skin. If it turns out that the cognitive system defined in a looser way so that kind of peripheral items could count as part of the cognitive system, then maybe it would be less surprising and less interesting that the cognitive system includes those things. And also, if the cognitive system is kind of defined in a way that includes the kind of less central, more peripheral contributors, then it's less clear that embracing extended cognition, if some of those peripheral contributors are found to be in the environment, then embracing extended cognition might not seem to have so much effect on cognitive science. Cognitive science would tend to focus itself on the most kind of central, most heavily integrated processes, the paradigmatic cognitive processes. All right, so one last concern, or what might be thought of as a concern, systems and cognitive systems. One might be concerned that CPC identifies only what it is for something to be an integrated system, but not a specifically cognitive system, right? You might think, when all of this has been said and done, I've offered you an interesting measure, but it's a measure that explains integration without really explaining what it is for something to be cognitive. We've got an integrated system, but not an account of cognitive systems. As a response, it might be reasonable to hold that a cognitive system is an integrated system, as CPC describes it, one that produces the data of interest to cognitive science, the various forms of behavior that provoke the undertaking of cognitive science, such forms of behavior as engaging in conversation, constructing scientific theories, playing chess, visually navigating the environment on boats, drawing up plans that are translated into buildings with structures that mirror those plans, and so on. And the idea is that the identification of an integrated system as a cognitive system is really a relational one. It is determined by the kind of output that integrated system produces. So you might think, yeah, there are lots of integrated systems throughout nature, throughout the world of artifacts that humans have created, but what makes something an X kind of system rather than a Y kind of system will be determined partly by what that sort of system does, what that integrated system does. And that seems reasonable. Does this yield a generic kind of cognition? Have we found something that might help us decide what the overarching property of being cognitive is? So back to the sort of concern that maybe different kinds of creatures, they might not have our kind of cognition, but they have some kind of cognition. What would be the common thread? For example, other integrated systems like plants produce different forms of behavior from humans. So perhaps they would be integrated systems, maybe even cognitive systems, but it would be a different kind of cognition. Nevertheless, that result depends largely, left something out of this slide. That result depends largely on the explananda and whether they exhibit shared properties across different kinds of integrated systems. Yes, so this is following up on the previous slide when I said whether something is an X sort of system will depend on the behavior it produces. So we might be integrated in the same way plants are. We're both integrated systems. CPC would deliver this so long as we allow for a different kind of explananda for the plants. They don't converse, they don't make scientific theories and so on, build experimental apparatuses. But once you allow for different explananda, then you've got a different kind of integrated system because what kind of integrated system you have is determined by the relation to the explananda, what kind of stuff it produces. Perhaps there's some other measure, degree of integration or tightness of integration, that's not binary necessarily, that doesn't draw a boundary around a cognitive system, but it's a measure of some kind of integration variation in which explains variation in a quantity such as flexibility in problem solving, which could be shared across different kinds of systems, humans and plants, even if they don't engage in the same specific forms of behavior. So this is a kind of research project that's worth pursuing, I think, is to say, well, even if plants don't produce the same kinds of behaviors as humans, their behavior is flexible in a way. And so maybe there's something about the way the internal mechanisms collaborate or co-contribute in plants that is similar to the way mechanisms co-contribute in humans. There's some variation in the extent of that integration that you can kind of measure across different systems. And that variation will help to account for different degrees of flexibility or different degrees of rigidity in the performance. Still, it won't be flexibility in the performance of intelligent behavior or the kind of behavior we're interested in humans. Like plants will be doing something quite different. So it's really hard to say whether we can find here a generic kind of cognition. This will be important tomorrow, though, as we turn in tomorrow's lecture to the question of whether groups can have minds of their own or engage in cognitive processing of their own. They're not plants. Groups are more like humans than plants are. But are they enough like humans? Well, that will be a topic for tomorrow. Thanks.